When people talk to me about being unhappy in their jobs, they usually talk about one of these four things. So they talk about, I hate my boss. My boss sucks. Or I don't like the people I work with. You know, like I think they're jerks or they're this or they're that. Or I hate what I do. I don't like what I actually do. Or I don't get paid well enough. I don't get good enough benefits. I don't have a good work-life balance. It's one of those four things. In some cases, it's a number of those four things. The idea that you should have a perfect job where you have an incredible boss, so incredible boss who like invests in you and believes in you and puts you in stuff. I think that's like, yeah, I want that for everybody. But the idea that you'd have a perfect boss and you would have a team that enables the best work you've ever done and you love what you do and you get paid really, really well, you earn your way into jobs like that.
Hello and welcome to In Control, your favorite leadership podcast. This time, our second episode in English, and my name is Thorsten Philipp.
Hello, and my name is Peter Trage. Thorsten, nice to see you again. And yeah, English again, right?
English again, and we talked about this before. I'm a bit nervous because the first time we did an English episode, this was an Austrian guy, a German guy as hosts, and our guest was Dutch. So nothing could go wrong. We could just use whatever words we thought are appropriate. This time we have a native speaker, and that makes me a little bit nervous. But yeah, let's see how we will perform, right?
I'm pretty sure we will manage, and our guest is already laughing in the background. So I would say we get him on board soon. But I'm fine, all right. But I promised I have a little intro that I can tell, a little story that I would like to share with you. Because probably it's a good introduction to the topic of today. All right, so last week I met my business partner. His name is Tomáš. He's from the Czech Republic. And besides business, we often have very interesting discussions about leadership, about life, sometimes even philosophy. And this time we talked about people, especially people from Europe, who are very unhappy with their lives, very often unhappy with their jobs, complain a lot. And Tomáš told me a story that really made me think a lot. You know, his father, he grew up in Czechoslovakia when it was still under a communistic regime. And back then, he for sure had a job, but he could not decide what kind of work he wanted to do, which company he wanted to work for, or even what position he wanted to have. So those decisions were made for him. And when this communist regime ended in 89, everything changed for him, and his father became an entrepreneur. He started his own company. And he kept telling his son, and he's about the same age like me, so it was probably 8 years when this regime ended, that there is something that he can be very lucky because he has something that his father did not have, namely the freedom of choice. He can decide whatever he wants to do in life. And if he is unhappy in his life, if somebody is unhappy in your job, if we're unhappy as leaders, we have the freedom to change something and we can choose a different path. And I think we all know that this change is not always easy. But having this freedom, I think having the freedom of choice is really a gift. And sometimes I think we forget about that. That was my intro.
Excellent introduction. Yeah, I'm pretty sure that we can talk about freedom of choice with our guest today. And talking about our guest, I want to take you back in history, into my history, to understand why this guest is so special to me. Because when I was a teenager, when I was starting to become an adult, I was heavily involved in the European punk rock and hardcore scene. I was going to shows around my hometown. I was setting up shows by myself. I was playing in bands. I was going to the places where different bands were playing. And of course, bands from the US were always super special to us. And that's where I met our guest today for the first time. And I mean, we didn't talk at that time. He was on stage. I was in front of the stage. He was playing for a band called Champion at that time. I was super, super excited. And fast forward more than 20 years later, we are both running a professional business. we met other people along the way that we know from that era. And when we started this podcast, we wanted to invite not only the typical business leaders, we also wanted to invite people who have maybe a different story, a different background. We had professional sports cyclists here. And today we have a former hardcore punk rock hero of mine. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Aram Erslanian. Hopefully I pronounce your family name correct, but welcome to the show, Aram. Good to have you here.
Thank you both so much. I really appreciate it. Thank you, Torsten, for the kind words. And Peter, that was a great story. Great intro.
Yeah. Thank you to have you here. It's super nice to meet you, Aram. I need to admit I'm not into punk rock too much, listening to NoFX a little bit. I have friends that are really into it. So let's not talk about that today. Otherwise, we'll be a little bit of of issue for me.
Maybe we can start there. And even though I had a few words about Aram already, of course, the first task is always to introduce yourself. Where are you today? Where do you come from? What's your profession? So please, Aram, give us an insight into your life.
So my name is Aram Erslanian. I am the CEO of Cadence Leadership and Communication, which is a consulting firm based in Vancouver, BC. I was born in Montreal, Canada, or Montreal, Quebec. Grew up in Calgary and went out to Vancouver, BC for university. And really, I came out here under the guise of going to university, which I did. But really why I came out here was to play hardcore and be in a bigger hardcore scene. And that led to me to doing a bunch of stuff in music. Cadence is a leadership coaching and development firm. So we do three things. The first thing that we do is individual and team coaching for high level, like senior level professionals. And that could be one-on-one work. It could be teamwork. The second thing we do is group learning. So we show people how to communicate effectively, how to give a good presentation, how to have a difficult conversation, how to have strong physical and verbal presence. And then the third thing we do is assessments. So we do 360s. We have an in-house 360 that is deeply, deeply based in like psychological principles. And it's a narrative-based 360. And I'm just going to say, frankly, they're like blow other 360s out of the water, because it's not some like hokey, I don't know, like really corny pick like one out of five thing. It's like all based on actual conversations with people and like listening to sentence structure and asking very like deep, specific questions. So these three things together is what has created what Cadence is today. The company started with just me, a cell phone and a notebook. And now 10 years later, so October is our 10-year anniversary, 10 years later, we are about to be 18 full-time people and about 30 consultants, and we work all over the world.
Cool. That's a pretty impressive career, I would say. When you explain that in the last 20 years from being into punk rock to founding your own company to now having 20 plus employees, that's really not bad. We had the same question to several of our guests, and I'm always very much interested in how much of that career was actually planned and how much did just happen. Can you fully walk us a little bit through that journey?
0% was planned.
All right.
0%.
All right. It's an answer we get quite often.
I would say now is the first time that I've started planning out the next, 5, 10 years. It's always just do the next right thing. And I started my career as a therapist. So my intention was to do addiction and mental health work for a career. And so I spent 10 years in Vancouver and the Vancouver area working with like frontline addictions and frontline mental health stuff. And it was incredible. It was an amazing, amazing job. I never, ever got burnt out on it or had any of those challenges because I'm such a believer in that work. And I'd say people in that industry globally are just absolute heroes in my mind, because it is some of the most crucial work that you can do. And it takes a great, great heart to be able to do it. But what got me into doing what I do now is in those 10 years, I saw so many really good therapists who, when they transitioned into being leaders, They couldn't figure it out. They couldn't port those skills over, those people skills. And it was like an interesting thing because I was quite young at the time, because I was very lucky to start my career. Even when I was playing in these bands, I always had like a career. I was quite young. So at first I was judgmental about it. I was like, when someone became a therapist and then, or went from a therapist to being a leader, I was like, oh, you know, they became one of them. They're like, they're management now. They suck. Like they've totally lost their edge or they're not about the work anymore. I had these like weird judgments about it. And then as I got a little bit older, I was like, I don't know, like maybe it's something about the culture of the place that we work in, or maybe it's something about them, or maybe it's something about the team. But it really came together when I then got my first leadership position and I stunk. I sucked. I was the worst. I bombed out. I didn't even last a year. I was so terrible. I fell into every trap that you would ever advise a young leader not to do. And then after that, I went back to just being a therapist. I was like, I can't do this. I'm terrible at this. So I went back to being a therapist and ended up doing what I felt was therapeutically the best work I'd ever done for the next few years before I got into what I was doing. So I had been very kind of like, I'd say I'd gone from judgmental to inquisitive to experiencing it myself, my own failure in that, and then retreated back, kind of got myself back together. And then I went into what I do now.
Awesome. I want to connect a little bit your and my history with what you are doing today. And when I remember the punk rock and hardcore scene more than 20 years ago, and I played in bands by myself, I was never the best musician out there. And the good thing about hardcore was always, it's not so much about being the best musician, but really you could compensate a lot by enthusiasm, by passion, by power, by doing things on your own, by yourself, the whole DIY thing. I mean, that's something that is, I think, a big part of what punk rock and hardcore is about. And today, and I have to say, I was a guest in your podcast, which was an amazing experience because it was so professional. So today you're running your business on a highly professional level, which might be a bit a different story to what hardcore is about. So my question to you is, I mean, how does that fit together? Did you learn being professional over the last 20, 25 years? Was this already part of yourself 25 years ago? Because let's be honest, in a professional setting, enthusiasm is a great basis, but it's not enough. You need to be highly professional. So how does this develop from being a hardcore kid, punk rock kid, to a highly professional entrepreneur, business owner, being responsible for 20 people, 30 more consultants in your network?
So I started playing guitar when I was 15. And I'm not much better now at 52 than I was at 15. I suck. I
like same here. Really...
I'm not good at it. But what I got good at over time, so I never became a good guitar player, but I became a good songwriter. And that took me a long time. It wasn't like it happened at this point and then all the success came. In each of those things, I was constantly learning and figuring out what works and what doesn't. But what I always did is I always surrounded myself with people who were better at things that I liked, that I thought were great. So it's not that I sought out the best guitar players because I knew I sucked at guitar. And frankly, it wasn't that I was trying to become better at guitar necessarily. I wanted to write good songs. So I started spending time with people who were incredible songwriters. I'll put a name out here. Peter, you won't know who this person is, but a guy named Todd Jones. Todd Jones and I became friends when he was still a teenager, and he was already like a phenomenal songwriter. And I just pay attention to what he does musically. Same with Aaron Kritzberg from The First Step. I would start spending time with people. And then as I got older, you know, I'd get to know people like Walter from Quicksand or Gorilla Biscuits. And I just became a student of great songwriting. So not being a better guitar player, but what makes a great song. And if you listen to like Beatles songs, for example, really, a lot of them are very, very simple. the chord progressions are simple. Like there is simplicity as a foundation allows you to build incredible complexity. And any business that starts like hyper complex right off the bat is probably going to have a lot of problems. So I never became a good guitar player. I became a pretty good songwriter, but then I became a really good organizer. So getting a bunch of like your weird friends, and you're weird too, getting a bunch of your weird friends together to practice once a week or twice a week for 2 hours, not only practice, but actually write songs. And not only write songs, like everyone has equipment and then you get t-shirts and you go play a show. That is like a crazy amount of organization you have to do, let alone taking that on tour, let alone taking that on a 6 week tour, let alone starting to play internationally, record records. So I never became a good songwriter or a good guitar player, but I became a pretty good songwriter. So I learned how to express myself well with limited tools, and I became a really good organizer. So when I started Cadence, I already had a lot of the toolkit, but none of it was about playing guitar. All of it was about the other stuff. But luckily for me, what I do, so in this case, we'd say playing guitar, it would be the version of playing guitar. I already had a background in therapy, so I was able to go into coaching very successfully. So in the world that I'm in now, I'm essentially a good guitar player, but I already had all the other skills from learning how to play in a punk band. There is no Cadence without me like slugging it out on the road for 6 weeks with all my like maniac friends. It's how I built the business, but I didn't realize I was setting myself up to build a business.
That's pretty cool. I like the link, the transition from being not a good guitar player to becoming the organizer and becoming the leader. There's obviously so much we can also learn from music. As I promised, I have no idea about punk rock, so there's not going to be a follow-up question on the punk. But I have a follow-up question on the psychology topic, because for me, it was quite interesting to hear when you explained when therapists become leaders, many of them are not successful. You said you tried yourself and it was very difficult. I also ended up as a leader in every single trap that is existing, and I became a leader first. And then I started not psychology, but I started systemic coaching and organizational development. And during that study, I learned a lot, but I learned it in hindsight, you know. For you, I mean, you studied psychology and obviously leadership psychology, there are lots of links. But how much did it help you to become a leader yourself? And what else you basically need to learn that is not in books and not in theory? Is there anything you can share with us?
Yeah. So the thing that made me not a good leader is my own perfectionistic, fear of failure got in the way. And the core of it is the work became about me not failing rather than about the work. And I'll give you an example. As a therapist, especially in addiction work, if you view yourself as the solution to someone's problem, you have already done a bad job for them, because it's not about you, it's about them and it's about their path. And if you think, oh, I'm going to meet this client and they are going to stop using drugs, or they're going to reconnect with their kids, or they're going to be able to like live a healthier, happier and healthy life because of the work I'm doing, you're done. You're totally done. And the way you should always think about it is anyone's journey to wherever they want to go, like whatever is fulfillment for them, is a journey of 1,000 miles. And as a therapist, you are honored to be able to walk with someone for a portion of that, and recognizing that the destination they're going to get to, you almost certainly will not be there. You won't be at the finish line for them. Instead, you just have to say, my job is to help them progress from step 265 to step 439. And I have to be content with just being a part of that. That's a discipline, and it's a real discipline where you have to pull your ego out. And you also have to pull your ego out saying, it's like, well, I want this person to be happy and I want this person to be healthy. And here's what I think will do that for them. That's like terrible, because again, it's very vulnerable when people come for therapy. You have to really, really meet people where they're at and totally accept it's not about what I want for them. It's about what they discover they want for themselves, and they can make that happen. So it's a very paced, very diligent work. Being a leader is different, as we know, because you have like, you know, responsibilities, you have things you have to get done, you have to build a team, you have to create like a functional system. But the core of it is like, if you put your ego in and you become afraid of failing, then your decisions are going to be based on fear-based reactions. You're not going to empower people. You're going to micromanage. You're going to become insecure. And all of those things are what happened. So what you said earlier, and like kind of you launched your question, why I saw so many therapists fail and why I failed is because you've got all this deep understanding of how to work with individuals or in groups and be very paced and very diligent and like not worry too much about the ultimate end result, but just always look for progress. When ego kicks in, at least for me, it overrode all of that logic. And I became like really like, no, we have to get this thing done. And I become totally fixated on it. And also just like afraid of failing and all of those things. It took me really failing. Like it was the first thing I'd ever really failed in my life is my first leadership job. And I like, not only did I eat it, I like ate it. I didn't get fired, but like, I definitely was like, I suck at this. This is like terrible. I was on tour with The First Step. We were in Spain and we just played this incredible show in Barcelona. I mean, it was amazing. And I'm sitting there playing, thinking about work and how unhappy I am and what a shit job I'm doing. And I was really like preoccupied, not in the moment. I went home that night, sent my boss an email and quit because I was doing so bad. But that set me up to do this. And I don't believe that everyone has to have some big dramatic failure. And the way I'm talking about it, it's probably more dramatic than it is. But for me, that's what I needed to be like, I let my ego get in the way.
Yeah, I guess ego is something that can really jeopardize your work as a leader. And you just mentioned it's not your job to solve the problems of your employees, but again, I mean, you're responsible for a whole business or for a part of a business. So you want to be successful with what you're responsible for, but that's simply not. It doesn't mean that you have to be the solution provider to everything, because then that really puts you into an incredible pressure. And I guess the leader has a completely different role, as you just mentioned it. I mean, and also in our life, I mean, we never know what happens to our people in the company. You have to, you support them for a certain period in their life. Maybe they will stay with the company for very long, but maybe they will leave. And so it's better to see it that way. Okay, it's my job to develop them for a certain period, and then let's see what happens.
Totally. Let me ask you a question, both of you. So Peter, you have your own consultancy, right?
Yep, right.
Okay. So are you, for all the people you consult with, for all of their businesses or all the things they do, are you an expert in everything that they do in their jobs?
No, absolutely not. Okay. But okay, continue, please.
Okay. Torsten, could you go into your company and manufacture something from start to finish?
80% of the jobs which are done in the company, I have no clue about.
Okay. When ego gets involved, I don't want to say people should be egoless, because that's crazy too. Like that's like a totally different thing. But like when our own fear or perfectionism or anxiety or any of these things get involved, we start thinking we know how to do things that we don't know how to do. So I talk about this this scale. It's just like a made up scale I have, which is like the pragmatist visionary scale. And I want you to imagine, so like a line like this, and at one end is a pragmatist. So those are people who just know how to do things and get things done. And visionaries are people who know how to think about things. If you think like right in the middle, someone who's equally visionary and equally pragmatic, I always think the best leaders, like the best like senior level leaders, are people who are one degree off of that. So they're really visionary. They can think of pretty good idea, like big ideas, but they also are pretty, they can do most of the stuff in their company. And the people who would be like good reports to them would be one off on the pragmatic scale. But as you get further in a business, you can't do all of the things. So you end up by nature going up position two. So you become actually a little bit less pragmatic, but you don't know, because you don't know how to do most of the stuff. And then, you know, you surround yourself with more pragmatists. But what you can never do is go all the way to the visionary side. Because all the way to the visionary side, it's like, I can think of all this crazy stuff, but I don't know how to do any of those things. That's terrible. You want to be able to have your feet on the ground to a certain degree as a leader and do know how to get your hands dirty and get stuff done, but never go all the way to the visionary side, because the complete visionary side, I have found psychologically, ego gets in play and people, they minimize how much work it takes to get things done and they minimize the expertise involved. They start thinking everything's easy when everything's hyper complex. Like everything is hyper complex. And like, even like think of the most basic job, it's hyper complex in its own way. So when people become too visionary, not only do they fail to realize how complex things are and they start thinking everything's easy and it should be done in a super quick time, but they also become detached from the human experience of doing things. So it's important to know like where you kind of fall in an idea like this. Like for me, I'm kind of like a position. I probably at this point, I'm more like a position two visionary where I can think really, really big. I know how to coach. I know how to facilitate, but I don't know how to do marketing or any of the other stuff that our company does. I need a lot of really strong pragmatists. But I'm never going to go all the way to just being some like, you know, totally like out there intellectual visionary. I probably don't have that capability in the first place, but also it's like, I don't ever want to get that detached from being able to do the business as well. So I'm like in a position two. Having your boots on the ground is super important, but you have to let go of the idea that you know how to do everything. And you also have to keep in mind that everything's hard to do. Everything, no matter what level it is, it's always hard to do. It has its own complexities.
Very helpful picture, I have to say. And we all know people who are 100% on the visionary side, where every organization will struggle to understand and to explain them. Hey, come on, I mean, on that high level bird view, okay, it looks super easy, and I like your idea, but there's, I mean, complexity involved and so on. So having at least one foot on the ground is, I guess that's absolutely important. Yeah. Fully agree on that.
Yeah. So to go to Peter, your consultancy, like let me relate it to playing in a punk band. As Torsten started with, like, I mean, I suck at guitar, like really bad. Like, it's embarrassing how bad I am now. Like,
at least you can play guitar. I'm just the stupid bass player. I can't even handle. I can't handle four strings. I'm not capable of handling six strings. It's even worse.
Like, I don't even use the other two strings. I might as well just play bass. Like. So I suck at guitar, but I always surrounded myself with good musicians. And I knew how to lead a band and then, you know, how to work with a record label and write songs and all that stuff. Playing guitar was the most, not the most minor part of it, but it was the part that required the less skill, the least skill for me. I had to know how to like orchestrate things and how to like build connections. So a consultancy, like if I go and consult for someone that's a technology company and they're like super high level engineers that are building like, let's say medical technology, I don't even know what they do. Like, I have no idea, but I really understand leadership. I understand company culture. So leaders don't need to understand. They don't have to have a great depth of understanding about the pragmatic stuff of what people do. They need to have enough of an understanding they can be in the mix, but they really need to understand leadership. They really need to understand culture. Mm-hmm. So you do want to have a pragmatic side. So a good consultant does not have to have the pragmatic sides of what someone's doing, but they have to have all the pragmatic sides of being like understanding leadership and culture or your consultancy. So being an expert in what your team does isn't necessary, but being an expert leader is.
Yep, I fully agree. And I think there is lots of similarities between being a leader of a team and being a consultant, because I fully agree. You don't have to be the expert for everything, and it's not even possible. And as a consultant, if I'm working with a company with deep technology, and if I come there and explain them how to do their job, I'm for sure going to fail. But it's the same as a leader. If I have employees that are strong on a technical level, and if I come and explain them how to do their job on that technical level, long term, it's not going to work. But if I'm able to orchestrate my team, and if I am able to have people that are skilled and have the freedom to do their job, then I'm going to be successful.
Heck yeah.
Yep.
All right. Let me tell you a story how we started, or why I approached Peter about 1.5 years ago about this podcast idea, because that was one of those silly ideas we have from time to time. And if you're not careful, you end up being a podcast host by yourself. So two times per year, I take a break, a bit longer one during summer and during winter, same as we all do. And besides doing something completely different, I always take my time to reflect on, okay, what was happening in the last 6 months? What came to my mind? And right before I approached Peter about this idea, I was sitting at my desk at home with a blank sheet of paper in front of me, writing down names which I've met during my career, former colleagues, business partners, customers, people who stood out, people who somehow inspired me. And there were the names first. It was very easy for me to write down 5, 6, 7 names. And then I started thinking about, okay, why is this name so important for me? What made this person so important? What did I learn? How did this person inspire me? And that was something which I told Peter 1.5 years ago. I said, well, come on, let's do something about leadership. We both know it's important. We both learn from people around us. And you've also mentioned, okay, you've learned from people who were better than you. And I think that's highly valuable and highly important that you reach out for, that you look out for who's better than I am, because you learn from those people. And that's my question to you. Do you remember the persons, the colleagues, the business partners, the friends which inspired you along the way? And what did you learn from them? I'm pretty sure you have 2 or 3 which really changed your view on different things.
Yeah, it's a great question. And going back to that idea, if you want to be good at something, surround yourself with people who are way better at it than you, way better, so much better that you're intimidated by it. I just want to tuck into an idea here that I think is super important. There's a difference between feeling intimidated versus someone acting intimidating. Those are two different things. So for example, like I mentioned Todd Jones earlier, who plays in this incredible band called Nails, and one of the most important bands in my life, a band called Carry On. Todd Jones is like, and he was in Terror and all these incredible bands. Todd Jones is like a gifted musician, a phenomenal songwriter. The times that I've been in a room with Todd and we're both playing guitar, I'm intimidated. I'm scared because he's so good. I'm embarrassed to play in front of him. And I get like nervous, like a little teenager nervous. That's good. So you should seek people out who give you that kind of like nervous feeling. Like I'm nervous to say something in front of this person. I don't want to look foolish. But then take that leap and say something and learn and observe them and be a real student of them. If you go to a jiu-jitsu gym, our 8-year-old child does jiu-jitsu. When I go there, these people are all like purple belts. They're serious athletes. I want someone of that level to teach my daughter. And their expertise is not just in jiu-jitsu. It's about getting people who are novices to roll with them. Right? So it's not just about knowing how to do jiu-jitsu. It's knowing how to encourage people to be brave enough to step on the mat with you and roll and learn. And you should learn from a master, but that should be kind of scary because you're like, oh, I'm with this person. So it's okay to be intimidated by someone, but it's never okay for people to act intimidating. So acting intimidating is being like derogatory, like cruel, dismissive of people, speaking down to people, yelling at people, being sexist or racist or any of those things. Acting intimidating is something that as leaders, we got to like step into, we have to eradicate, we need to push hard on, we have to help people move past, and we can't accept that culturally. But when people say like, oh, so-and-so intimidates me, I'm always like, well, do they act intimidating or are you intimidated because they're so good at something that it makes you nervous? And I think that first one, surround yourself with people who you find intimidating that you're nervous about, as long as they don't act intimidating. I'll go into answering your question now, but do you guys have any thoughts on that?
I really like that picture, and it's super cool because also for me there is people where I really learned a lot, and especially the, let's say, thinking about the difference. Am I intimidated because that person is so good, or does that person act intimidating? Is something I really appreciate. And thinking back, I think I'm also very proud, and most likely it's the same for you, Thorsten, where we have met people that grew, let's say, because we've been their leaders, and I know some of them, they already overtook me, which makes me actually very proud, because I know them now 20 years, and they have worked for me, and now they are in positions that are really, well, impressive to see.
Yeah. Yeah. There's one thing that I want to share with you before. I'm curious about your answer, but as you mentioned, the sports aspect, and I have the same here. I mean, my son is playing football. And of course, in sports, you always look for a coach who's better, you look out to the superstars, to the Ronaldos and Messis and whoever. So in sports, it's completely normal that you search for someone who's better, where you can learn. And I find it a bit interesting that sometimes in business, we are afraid to meet people who are way better than we are. Yeah. But it's the same story. If I want to grow, I mean, I still have 20 years to go in my professional life, even more. Hopefully, I will get better and better year by year. But that means I have to look out for people who are great coaches, who are way better than I am. I have the impression very often in our professional life, people are afraid to show that weakness. Let's put it that way, and to look out for different business leaders who are super experienced, way better than we are. Because in sports, it's normal.
Yeah. And like, who wants to go to a coach? Like, let's say you want to learn how to play basketball. You want to be a basketball team. Who wants to go and then be surrounded by people who don't take it seriously, who aren't good at it, like, or who think exactly. They're good at it, but they actually suck, like all of that. But what you'd said about that, the nervousness that people have about being around professionals who they feel like, oh, this person's not a little bit better than me. They're way better than me. Okay, if we pull it all back, let's just go to the simplest thing. Well, of course, people want to be good at what they do, but also people want to have a job. People need to make money. They need to have a living. So just from like a resources point of view, I can understand why people are like, well, actually, I kind of want to be the top of the dog pile here because that way I'm safe and I've got a good job. And viewing it from like a scarcity model, it totally makes sense to me why people would want to be top of the pile or kind of like maybe mid pack and be like, I'm safe, going from a safety perspective and a scarcity model. But flip it. And Peter, I want to circle back to what the story that you led with earlier. I don't think security is about being like the big fish in a small pond. And it could be that for some people. That's never been it for me. I want to be able to be in the ocean and be pretty confident in myself and like, and also like figure out what I have to do to get better and better and better. I don't want to be in the small pond. Everyone's different. It's not a right or wrong. It's what's good for you. But for me, I think the challenge of being around people who are way smarter than you and way better than you, but also figuring out how to like connect with them and learn from them and help them learn from you. That's like, to me, that's what it's about. Like, that's like, whatever the business is, growing personally, growing professionally, like kind of figuring out how to walk a different way and walk with more confidence and walk with more like understanding of yourself and other people. That's the gig. Like, that's what I think the gig is. So I always want to do that. So Peter, I want to go back to your commentary about freedom. It was a beautiful story, super cool story. I want to share with you guys what I see in the work world that people struggle with. And it's the idea of the perfect job. So I want you guys to think of like a four quadrant grid, like a big plus sign. When people talk to me about being unhappy in their jobs, they usually talk about one of these four things. So they talk about, I hate my boss. My boss sucks. Or I don't like the people I work with. You know, like I think they're jerks or they're this or they're that. Or I hate what I do. I don't like what I actually do. Or I don't get paid well enough. I don't get good enough benefits. I don't have a good work-life balance. It's one of those four things. In some cases, it's a number of those four things. The idea that you should have a perfect job where you have an incredible boss, so incredible boss who like invests in you and believes in you and puts you in stuff. I think that's like, yeah, I want that for everybody. But the idea that you'd have a perfect boss and you'd have a team that enables the best work you've ever done, and you love what you do, and you get paid really, really well, you earn your way into jobs like that. You don't get a job like that right off the bat, or very rarely do people. You earn your way into it. And the only way you earn your way into it is going into situations that aren't that. So as an example, you might love what you do. Love it. I loved being a therapist. It's amazing. The team I worked on was phenomenal. My boss, not all of them, but many of them stunk. They're terrible. And the pay was awful, like so bad. But I loved what I did and my team was great. And that team helped me grow and do the best work I could ever do. Great. I learned, you know. And then I went into the world that I'm in now and I worked at someone else's shop for a long time. I loved what I did. My team, they're okay. Let's just say they were a little bit wavery. The pay was phenomenal. It was like, I'd never been paid so much money in my life. I was like, oh my gosh, like this is so crazy. My boss sucked, but I learned a bunch. And like, you can have a bunch of different configurations like that. But the idea to get to this perfect job is you have to be willing to say, what's the most important thing for me out of these four? What matters to me? Then what's a secondary concern, a third concern? Like, you know, go from there. Getting all four of these lit up is all about playing a game of chess and really surrounding yourself with the right people and making good, diligent choices. At the end of the day, though, it's about freedom. You have to decide what is most important to me. And what is most important to me? I want to love what I do. That's the most important thing. I'm willing to take less money. I'm willing to have maybe a crappy boss. And I hope you don't. Like, I hope those things aren't out there. But when people say they hate their jobs and they act like there's not freedom, there is freedom. Like, you can go to get another job. And I know it's hard out there and I know it's difficult, but I'm not saying on Tuesday, go quit your job. If you want another job and you're unhappy with your job, go to school or take courses or start getting a mentor or go get a coach, go do some self-improvement, go read some books. It's about freedom and arming yourself to get that perfect job, to get that thing. But that's a journey and it's a hard one. I don't want to minimize anyone's discomfort here, but like, you can't just sit in your own shit and complain about stuff. If you want something, you want a job that all four of these quadrants are lit up or three of them, or the ones that matter to you, then go out and do it. That's what matters.
Mm-hmm. But also, and I think that is also important to mention, it's really difficult to achieve all of those four targets. And sometimes it's also about being a little bit realistic, I would say. What is, like what you explained, what is really important to me, what really matters, and focusing on that. Yeah.
Anyway. So let me ask you a question. Torsten, have you ever had a terrible boss, like a really like crappy boss?
No, not a crappy one, but bosses where I simply did not share the same ideas and it was like, yeah, and you can handle this for a while, but for me it is important to be at least somehow aligned with how he sees what is important and what I see what is important, and I like the idea of what you just mentioned, freedom of choice. I mean, it does not mean that it's easy and doesn't mean that you automatically need to do this tomorrow. But if you feel that, okay, this is really the issue, then you have to change it from my point of view. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't want to live an unhappy life. I spend way too much time in my job.
Yeah. And you know, anyone listening to this is like, oh, you're minimizing, you know, the struggle of people professionally. No, like I'm intimately involved in the struggle of people professionally. It's what I do all day, every day at like very senior levels, but also system levels where I end up kind of having a purview into people who are more on the front line. And it is tough out there. It's a tough economy. It's always tough to get new jobs, but really thinking about what is going to make me feel happy. What is going to make me feel fulfilled of these four things? Which one matters first, second, tertiary, then go from there. And making choices that will get you on the path to what you want. Some people can work with a boss they hate for a long period of time, as long as they love what they do and they get paid well. I can't, but some people can. Figure out what matters, make the choices to get there, because life is way too short to work in a job that you hate. And it's not cool. And you have the freedom to choose a different path. It doesn't mean it's easy. It's actually very, very hard, but everything worth doing is hard. Everything. Peter, any thoughts on that?
I was just thinking about the leaders that I had in the past. And I mean, I'm lucky because I co-founded my first company almost 20 years ago. So I've been my own leader very often. But I can think about one leader that was really bad because he was actually just not honest with me very, very often. But at the same time, that was also something that was really important for me because I was exactly thinking about what is really important for me. Is the salary? Is the team? And I simply understood I cannot work with somebody that is not honest or even lying every now and then to me. And then that made me really change my life almost completely. And so sometimes you can see it also in a very positive way, because the story that I told you in the beginning of this podcast was also about, like, I know many people that are really unhappy in their jobs, and not thinking about which ones of those quarters is bad, but like, if someone is telling me I'm now 40, I'm 43, I'm 45, whatsoever, but I'm not going to change my job, it's not that bad. I mean, I'm complaining every day, but it's just another 20 years until I can retire. I mean, this is really painful to hear, but there is so many people out there that think like that. The question is, what could be behind that, Aram? And I'm pretty sure you talked to some of those people. Probably you even had some of those people in your podcast, don't know. But tell us a little bit, what could be behind that?
This is a really, really good question. So the idea of a perfect job, and I want everyone to have a perfect job. Of course I do, but it's unrealistic. Most people are not going to have a perfect job, but most people can get three of these things lit up for sure. Like, so for example, you could have an incredible boss. You could have a great team and you could get paid and have great benefits, but maybe you don't particularly love what you do. It doesn't mean you hate it, but you're like, yeah, it's fine. But man, my boss is great. I learned so much. I'm like, it's very intellectually stimulating to be around this person. My team is cool. I get paid well, or whatever the other thing. It's actually pretty practical. Most people could have three of these things lit up. Baseline two, but if you only have one of those things lit up, so for example, let's say you get paid a ton, but you hate your boss, you don't like what you do, and your team sucks, you don't like, they don't enable you to do the best work. That's when people make a lot of money, but they're like, they're hollow inside. And I've been in that experience where, like, the first consulting gig I had, I didn't like my boss, my team. It was kind of a complex thing. I'll actually tuck into that in a second. I liked coaching, but I didn't like coaching at this company because it was kind of a weird thing. But I got paid a shit ton of money, way more money than I ever made as a therapist, like triple the amount of money. But it changed me. It made me an unhappy person. And I was the unhappiest I've ever been in my life working at this consulting firm. Arguably, I should have been the happiest. I had like a corner office in like a skyscraper downtown Vancouver, had this incredible view. I was able to travel the world and do all this stuff, got paid a ton of money, but I was like hollow inside. And it was really, I was just there for how much money I made. And why didn't I stay? I didn't leave because I'm not going to say this about anyone else. I didn't have the courage to do it. I didn't have the accountability of being happy in my own life. I felt like I'm in this job. I'm never going to find a job I make as much money as this. Having this amount of money allows me to live this kind of lifestyle. And as a sidebar, the lifestyle I was living was totally unhappy. It's the worst version of me that has ever been. Like, I was like super unhappy, and having the money and the ability to do things didn't do anything good for me. It just meant that I had a number in my bank account. I stayed in there because I didn't have the courage to change and I didn't have the will to change. I just viewed it as my right to just sit around and point out how everything was wrong around me and how if I was in the chair, it would be all different. And I just sat in my own shit and complained. It goes down to a very basic psychological principle. Individuals and systems often resist change, even change that would be good for them, because they think the pain of change is more than the pain of staying the same. So they view changing, that's going to be way too hard, way too difficult, way too scary. I'm going to lose this. I'm going to lose that. So they view that change as being more painful than the pain of their daily existence. But if you take that daily existence and you extrapolate that out by 20 years, there's no way the pain of change is more. But systems and people only are fully willing to change psychologically. They have to get there if they understand that the pain of staying the same is actually far more than the pain to change. And if you can get someone there, so that's like a lot of the work that I do is like I help people understand and organizations understand the pain of staying the same is so monumentally more than this pain of change. If people can adopt that, boom, they'll change like that. They'll take the craziest leap. They'll do the biggest thing. So when I talk about these quadrants and try and break it down, it's like, if you want all four of those, you want to go for that, that shit is going to be painful and that's going to be hard, but that's what you should do. Go into the most difficult, challenging situations, learn all the things you can, build your own thing, earn your right into those four quadrants. And earning your right to have a good job is something that I encourage people. It's like, you can go to school, you can do all the stuff, but you got to earn your right by going out, experiencing it, making good choices, and living in that pain of change. So that was the answer, is that the people stay in there because they view the pain of change is more than the pain of staying the same.
Excellent.
All right. So Torsten, I didn't answer your question. I'm sorry. I'll tell you the people that really stood out to me.
No worries. We want to give room for those discussions because they are so valuable, but please, I want to learn.
So I worked with this incredible therapist named Diane. I worked at this, there's an area called New Westminster, which is just like a suburb of Vancouver. And this was my last gig as a therapist. And Diane had been a therapist for, I don't know, like 30-ish years at that time. And she had become a therapist before you had to have a master's degree in it. You could essentially, at the time when she became a therapist, you could just be like a well-intentioned person and become a therapist and just get like kind of basic training. So she'd been a therapist forever. And she was grandfathered into like being able to be a therapist at this place, although the rest of us all had to have master's degrees. She was hands down easily the best therapist I ever worked with. Who cares? She didn't have a master's level education. So she didn't have a piece of paper on the wall, but her skill level, her understanding of people, her ability to read a situation through the absolute roof, her patience, her kindness, her diligence and her practice. I learned more from working with her for 2 years than I learned in all of my school education. She was absolutely phenomenal. She also beefed with my boss at the time. So my boss at the time of my last therapy gig was like a painter. Like he painted on the side and he forced all of us to put his art in our offices. And it's not that he wasn't a good, like he was fine, but he painted these like really like intense things. And he put one, like he would come in on the weekends and put his art in your office. And he put this painting in her office that he was like, oh, it's like a sun rising. Like, you know, it's like the sun can kind of be reddish as it's rising. And she was like, I feel like his giant red eyeball is like always in my office, like staring at me the whole time.
Like Lord of the Rings, right?
Lord of the Rings. Like Lord of the Rings.
That was actually the reference she made. Was Lord of the Rings. So Diane would be number one. And there's a lot of people along the way, but I'm going to point out three more. There's a guy named Rob Hansen. Rob Hansen is a senior level in a sales leader in technology. And Rob was the reason that I started Cadence. I was working at this other consulting firm. And I was like just miserable. I hated my job. I hated doing it. Like I liked what I did. I liked working with people, but I didn't like the nature of this company and the way they positioned themselves in the market. It really always felt like we were being ingenuine. Felt like that to me. Anyways, I was working with Rob Hansen and we were having dinner one night with a big group of people. And he just leaned over and said, why don't you just start your own company? And I was like kind of taken aback. And of course I'd had the fantasy of starting my own company. And I was like, well, what do you mean? And he's like, what you do is clearly different than what your company says it does. Why don't you just start a company doing that? And I was like, oh, you know, all the kind of excuses and da, da, da. He was like, no, go do that. I'll be your first client. I will be your client if you do that. And I left there thinking like, geez, like I actually should do this. And it was like a really powerful moment. And what I learned from Rob Hansen is like, you know, a guy from like a small town, middle America, like grew up like hunting and fishing and all that kind of stuff. Just like a real kind of salt of the earth guy. But he was really good at identifying what people should do next in their careers. And he would just pick someone and be like, you should do this. And this guy is like a Johnny Appleseed of careers. Like you can look back and there are going to be hundreds of people who are like, I did this because Rob Hansen told me to. And it really inspired me where I was like, don't play small, like go do that thing. And to see someone so willingly take responsibility for helping other people take the next step was like a huge thing for me, really inspiring. And then the other two people I'll say is there's a guy named Scott Patterson, who is the CEO of a company called First Service. And it's like a holding company for a bunch of US and Canadian based companies, like really incredible success story. You guys might've heard of Colliers International. So Colliers International is one company and First Service is their sister company. Scott Patterson is the best CEO I've ever worked with. And the reason why is he actually intimately totally knows the details of all of the businesses. Like this guy's got like so many businesses under this portfolio and he could talk about like a mid-level manager in one of these businesses in a heartbeat while also being able to the next breath talk about like the overall performance of all the companies in the portfolio. His ability, his attention to detail is shocking. And it always reminds me that I need to bring my A game in every single conversation with him. I need to know exactly what I'm talking about. I need to know where I'm going with it. I need to have no vagueness with it because he's going to ask a really good question afterwards. And I'm going to have to be like, all right, I need to be able to answer this. He's so smart. He's so on it, but he's also like a really good guy and just like a decent human being. Knowing that someone can be that smart, that on it, but also be like a genuinely good person, really like set my mind in that space of, because like, I'm sure we've all heard, it's like, you know, the thing about CEOs is they're all sociopaths or they're all like, you know, this or that. It's like, that's like such a cheap way. I understand why people latch on to stuff like that, but it's just like weird dime store, like psychology. It holds no water. There are a percentage of CEOs like that. But I'll tell you, a guy like Scott Patterson, he's such a decent human being, but also such a good professional. It's like, I want to be around people like that. And then the final is a guy named Jason Wubs. Jason Wubs is part of the Wubs family, which is like this family of business people in British Columbia. Their father started a company called Westland Insurance, and he took it from like just one little agency to now they're like a huge Canadian company. And the Wubs are really, really, really good business people. I've spent a lot of time around Jason. I used to coach him when he was a CEO, and then I helped with the transition from him into the new CEO. And now I still coach the whole executive team in that company. But Jay has gone on to do private equity and purchase other companies and help them grow. I have watched how this guy does it. I mean, this guy doesn't need to work. You know, he's been successful. His family's been successful. This guy is so invested in helping companies grow and like, and good things happen and the right things happen. And it always gets me super fired up. I was just with him the other day. I get super fired up because although this guy has been part of this huge journey and, you know, like of like already professionally, and now he's kind of in this second part of his thing, he still is excited about helping some small company become like successful as he was for his own company many years ago. And it's like that, like eternal optimism and desire to help people is just like totally gets me psyched. So it'd be those four people: Diane, Jason Wubs, Rob Hansen, and Scott Patterson.
Whoa, I'm pretty impressed with the list and also with all the experiences that you shared. I think reminds us about what you said: surround yourself with people that are way better than you, and you can learn, you can improve. That's really, really pretty cool. Aram, it's really nice to discuss and talk with you. And I think we could listen to your stories for another hour. But at the end, time is flying a little bit. So I would say let's skip the one or the other question that we prepared and come to our favorite questions. You know, you mentioned a few times in the podcast already that you did something where you've been quite bad. You sucked, you said. But we want to hear one real story where you say, okay, this is something I can share. Where you really, really fucked up. So Aram, what do you describe as your biggest fail?
This is last year. So one of my failings as a person is I really, really, if I know someone really wants to do something, I struggle sometimes with being like, this is a terrible idea. And if I'm in like a straight up cult coaching perspective, no problem. Or if it's like one of my kids, I could be like, that's a terrible idea, don't do that. But if it's someone who I'm not directly coaching, but I'm working with professionally, and they have an idea and I'm like, I don't think you should do that, I have a real deep hesitancy with being like, hey, this is a terrible idea. And I was in a situation a year ago where a professional wanted to do something at a company offsite, and they wanted me to help. And I didn't say no. And I should have said no. Like, I really should have said no. Like, hey, I don't think this is a good idea, and this is why I don't think it's a good idea. But the person is such a good person. They're a great professional. They wanted to do it for all these really, really good reasons. I just understood the psychology of the group they were dealing with and the situation. And I didn't want to say no to them, but I knew it wasn't going to work. So not only did this wonderful person like trust me enough to do this thing, but then I went in and did it, and I did a shit job. I was terrible because I didn't believe in the thing and I knew it wasn't going to work. So I went in like, it was like going in to play a hardcore song at like a country festival. Like, you know, people are like, what are you doing? This sucks. And in literally real time, I knew what I was doing was the wrong thing. And it was because I couldn't say no to this person. And you'd think that's crazy. I'm like in my 50s. I've got all this stuff I've done. I didn't want to hurt this person's feelings. So the outcome of that, I flew all the way to this place to go do this session that was a complete disaster. And whose fault was it? It was my fault, because I had the ability the whole way to turn to change this. Afterwards, I spoke with this person and they apologized to me. And I was like, no, I apologize to you. This is my fault. You trust me, and I didn't do the right things here. We have a better working relationship as a result, because like I owned it. I took accountability for it, and we're still working together. Actually, we just did another session, and it was phenomenal. It was really, really good. But one of the things that I learned is like, I cannot let my own discomfort with hurting someone's feelings keep me from helping the right thing happen. And that was like just literally months ago that happened.
Excellent. That's basically the reason why we ask this question, because with each and every failure, with each and every mistake you learn, or at least you have the ability or the chance to learn something really valuable about your organization, about yourself. And I think that's a great learning.
I also I also recently text messaged a CEO a song from Spotify by mistake. It was there was this Canadian rap metal band called Ragadeth.
Ragadeth.
Ragadeth. It was just like a Canadian thing in the either the late 90s or the early 2000s. And my group of friends were talking about Ragadeth. And I was like, oh, and I went to go send to forward a Ragadeth song to a friend of mine. And I sent it to a CEO of a company. And they were like, what the hell is this? That happened like 2 months ago.
Yeah. You're still working with those guys?
Oh, yeah. It was a great story.
Okay. I have to admit, same as Peter just said, well, I love to talk to you for another hour, and maybe we need to just invite you a second time. But yeah, trying to come to an end to keep this episode, I mean, we already failed to stay below our 1 hour benchmark, but I think there was enough valuable input. But I'd love to combine this last question with something we had on our list before. After the biggest fail, there's always the question of the biggest success. But maybe before you can tell us, okay, where are you super proud of yourself? What would you define as your biggest success in your professional career? Maybe just let us know, what does success mean to you? Because that's a very individual question. I mean, in a company setting, you can nail it down to business figures or whatever, something that the shareholders defined as as success. What's success for you, and where do you see your biggest success in your career?
The biggest success in my career, this is the easier one to answer, is I get to work with my wife every day, and we get to travel together for work. I don't go anywhere. My wife and I go everywhere together for work. She's the chief of staff of our company. And my biggest success is not sacrificing family time, time with my wife, and time with our kids, because two of our kids work in the company. The third one is still very young. I am able to maintain a totally plugged in family life. And that is like, for me, the biggest success. I love my wife. She's my absolute best friend. I get to go everywhere with her. And that to me is super important. So that's my biggest success, is building the business in a way that, that allows that. So what does success look for me? I don't want to sound grandiose, but it's like pretty practical. And what I mean by this is like, for me, success is increasing empowerment for people while reducing suffering. And suffering, it sounds like grandiose, like, oh my gosh, but I just wanted to think, like, if someone works at a job that sucks, they're suffering. If someone can't communicate well and they want to communicate their ideas, they're suffering. If someone gets paid shit, they're suffering. And like, the idea that work is such a profound part of our life. And if you're in a place like a work culture that it's terrible, or you have a bad boss, or you feel, you know, like you feel minimized, or you don't know how to express your ideas, these are all different forms of suffering. And I just want to reduce suffering for people. And whether that's like showing someone like, hey, here's how you answer a question better, or here's how you can help yourself be heard, or here's how you kind of push back against a negative culture. Amazing. That to me is reducing suffering. But I also want to increase empowerment. And what I mean by that is that like a really good coach should never create forever situations. You should get so good at teaching people things that they themselves can become the teachers. That's the point. And so I want to empower people to feel like they could go out and do a version of what I do, or teach a version of what I teach, or like take these ideas and like put them in play. So if I'm increasing empowerment and reducing suffering, then I'm being successful at what I'm doing.
Impressive answer.
Thank you.
All right. Pretty cool conversation, I would say, and so much I have learned. So, well, Aram, thanks a lot for being here.
Yeah. Before saying thank you, first of all, Peter, you're absolutely right. I've learned so many things during this last 60 minutes, and I'm super happy that we try to reconnect my past life with our current setting. And that's what I like with the In Control podcast. And it has proven again today, I learn with each and every episode. So Aram, thank you very much for being here and sharing your view and your experience with us. Thanks so much.
Okay. And thanks to both of you. Like, the idea of podcasting, this is the thing, like this is like punk to me. Like, we all didn't go to like broadcasting school and like learn how to be interviewers or do any of these things. It's like, you guys were like, hey, let's just do this thing. Yeah. Get people talking, share ideas, like poke holes in each other's ideas. Nothing is cool unless people come together and make it cool. And you make things cool through conversation, like jujitsu, getting people on the mat, wrestling around with ideas. The more you're willing to do that, enter the fray, be in the conversation, be a little scared, but then learn how to do it well. That's how you make things better. And nothing gets better if we all just hide in our corners and think we're right, or think that, you know, like nobody gets us. You got to be in the fray. So gents, I really appreciate that you do this, and thank you for inviting me.
All right. Thanks, Aram.
That's punk rock.
Nice summary of our DIY project, Thorsten, right?
Okay. Really? Yeah. I never thought about it from that perspective. Thanks a lot. Hey, talk to you soon.
All right. Take care, guys. Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
Bye.